Hello, listeners, and welcome to Junk Dilemmas, an Irvine Welsh podcast. I am your host, Damien Kiley, and every episode I'll talk about an Irvine Welsh book or an adaptation of one of his books. And today I'm not alone in doing so. I have an esteemed colleague here with me, a good friend of mine, Mr. James King. Say hello, James.
Good evening.
James, on the mean streets of Kildare, you're known as James, so I'll probably refer to you as such from now on in the podcast, if that's all right.
Yes, that's fine by me.
Good stuff. So you're a massive Irvine Welsh fan, James.
Massive. 6'4".
Yeah, you've actually got a tattoo of him on your back, I believe.
I certainly do.
I think that last part is false, but you have read The Acid House and you're happy to talk
several
about
times.
It. Several times. Good. So have I. So that's what we're going to talk about today. It's Irvine Welsh's first short story collection entitled The Acid House. A couple of things to clarify first. Once again, I am not affiliated in any way with Irvine Welsh. I'm just a fan of his. And we will be discussing content of an adult and controversial nature today. So again, if you have any children, please get them out of the room now. Yeah, so let's get into it. Let's get into the backstory of the book. Okay, so The Acid House was released very soon after Trainspotting, and I think he possibly, you know, was writing it during writing Trainspotting, because there is parts of it that sound quite similar when you're reading them. It had taken about 2 years after we finished Trainspotting before it was actually on bookshelves. But as for the name, The Acid House, well, we know that he's a big fan of Acid House music, and he was actually inspired to start writing more seriously after attending raves and had this kind of epiphany to write in a certain style, which became his signature, you know, Scots dialect. Welsh himself has said about the collection, after I finished Trainspotting, I just kept on writing. I was enjoying it so much, it became a hobby, more than a hobby, so I saw no reason to stop. I wrote most of the stories when I should have been employed at Edinburgh Council. I liked the freedom to be more surreal, hyper-real and fantastical. It came out just 6 months after Trainspotting, and it initially sold more copies. The Trainspotting play, then the film, took that book to a new level. Paul McGuigan did the Acid House film, which was produced by Alex Usborne and David Muir. I liked the film very much. I did the screenplay, which I did enjoy. It was an uninspired hack job on old material, and I vowed never to adapt my own stuff again. So that's what he thinks of the Acid House movie, which we'll also be discussing as well in a future episode. Some of the stories from this collection were published in magazines like Rebel Inc., which, as I said before, Welsh was had a big relationship with, and in other collections like Folks by Clock Tower Press, who had also published Trainspotting. This book was published in early 1994 by the publishing house Jonathan Cape, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House Publishing. It did become popular with fans of actual Acid House music and younger fans in general, some of whom were not actually familiar with Trainspotting, but then backtracked and bought that too. So although Trainspotting is undoubtedly Welsh's magnum opus, it did initially get a helping hand from this collection. This book is dedicated to his parents, Peter and Jean Welsh, and it also includes at the start a poem by a brilliant and troubled Scottish poet, Paul Reekie, who was a friend of Welsh and an integral part of Rebel Inc. I think the poem, which is entitled When Caesar's Mushroom Is in Season, It really sets the tone for the madness that follows quite well. The book covers, James, I know you have just read the cover that has the fly on the front.
I have indeed.
Mr. Bob Coyle. I know the first edition had a dog on the cover, a dog wearing one of those cones that stops it from biting its stitches after a trip to the vet, which is strange because I don't remember a dog like that in any of the stories.
No, don't think so. No. Very little dog references in it.
He does mention a lot of dogs in future books, but not so much in this one. But just on the general plot and structure then. So The Acid House is a collection of short stories, some very short, as in less than one page. And it's accompanied at the end by a novella entitled A Smart Cunt. Some of the stories are very akin to Trainspotting, which makes sense, as it was written so soon afterwards, while others are kind of equal parts bizarre and comedy pieces. Some that are far more far-fetched than anything that kind of intrusively gay-crashed Mark Renton's head in Trainspotting. As for the characters, main or otherwise, well, there's too many and too little of them to mention here, so we'll just talk about them as and when they come up. So let's get into it. Let's get into the breakdown of the story.
And folks, don't forget to follow our social media accounts. On Facebook, it's Junk Dilemmas, an Irvine Welsh podcast. On Instagram, it's Junk_Dilemmas. And on Twitter, it's Junk_Dilemmas. So check them out for updates on new episodes and content.
Okay, so the first story is entitled The Shooter. Yeah, set the scene in this one, James. Do you remember it?
No.
Yeah, so it's about a Scots guy, but I presume he's Scottish, considering he's called Jock.
Yes.
He was pogging around with this fella, Gary, who's seems to be a man on the edge. He's not long out of prison. Seems to have a few issues going on upstairs and a burning desire for revenge on a fella called Whitworth.
Yeah.
Tony Whitworth, it is. But as the story went on, I got the sense that Jock would be doing something with Gary's missus and it would take on from there, but it didn't go. It took a turn the other way, actually.
Yeah. I didn't pick up on that at all now. I just was concentrating on the fact that this guy, Gary, had definitely had a few screws loose. As I say, he was kind of shouting at his daughter over dinner. And interestingly enough, the daughter and the mother are called Lisa and Marge, which I don't think I picked up on the first time I read it, but... Yeah, they've got revenge on their minds. You know, Jock is kind of convinced by this guy to go around and give this fellow Whitworth a good scene to and scare him into repaying his money.
I think it's only 2 grand or something.
Ah, sure, 2 grand is 2 grand, James.
That's awesome.
It was a funny part when Jock goes to get supplies for the occasion, when he goes to a sports shop and buys a baseball bat. And then thinks about getting a ski mask to go along with it, but then thinks it'll look a bit too suspicious with the shop assistant. So
it's a bit like the peep show where they go around to kick the shit out of your man and they buy a baseball bat and a mitten. So they can't get stopped, we're just playing baseball.
When he goes around to pick up Gary, then Gary actually has a gun. So this obviously puts the shits up Jock a bit, but Gary assures him that it's not actually loaded, it's just to scare your man. But apparently not. When they get to the door, as soon as he answers the door, his little lad answers the door first in an Arsenal jersey, I believe.
If he was indeed, that was a tragedy in this
town. But as soon as your man Whitworth comes to the door, he gets his face blown off.
It was without ceremony, there was no big build up or lead up, but he just blew the face off.
Yeah, it took Jock out of nowhere, surprised him that he actually thought it was some sort of an elaborate hoax between the two of them, that he was on you've been framed or something, but sadly not. It's, a disturbing scene, I imagine, but they get the hell out of there. They go back to Jock's apartment and this guy Gary turns on him then, which I suppose is the twist at the end of this story.
A couple of home truths. I heard that you were seeing quite a lot of my missus when I was inside, mate. He says softly, caressingly.
Yeah.
Which is very worrying.
Absolutely. And this is after... Yes. And this is after, on the way back in the car, I forgot that he justified killing your man by saying that he was carrying on with Gary's missus while he was in prison, and also interfering with his daughter, which is obviously very sinister. But the fact that he is now turning this on Jock as well, you're just left wondering, is this true? Even if it is true, it still doesn't justify what he's done or what he's about to do to Jock, or whether it's just all in his head and he's just a paranoid freak.
I'd wager it was in his head.
Yes, either way.
And Jock is getting his head blown off too.
Yes, quite possibly, and I don't think it wagers too well for the safety of Marge and Lisa either long term.
Although they seem to be surviving.
Yeah, 30 years in the business. So that's the first story that kind of sets the scene for the madness that follows. The next one is entitled Euro Trash. And it kind of starts off, it reads almost a bit like a sequel to Trainspotting, because it's a guy fresh off heroin from Leith arriving in Amsterdam, which is pretty much the path that Mark Renton took at the end of Trainspotting. And ironically enough, this character is called Ewan as well. He's just hanging around in a mate's apartment in Amsterdam. I think he's very much like Mark Renton. He's very misanthropic. He doesn't want to have much to do with people by his own admission. And he kind of just is wandering around Amsterdam aimlessly when he ventures into a bar one night and encounters, I suppose, a couple. It's a barman entertaining a woman at the bar.
Yeah, well, he's over in Amsterdam living with his mate. His mate back in Scotland is known as Rab. Hmm. But over in Amsterdam, he's changed himself to Robbie and it's a completely new man.
It really sounds much better, doesn't it?
This sickens young to his core. But the two of them, they're good mates, but you can see when living together, they just hate each other. Not his roommates. But yeah, as you say, he was out one night and he goes into the bar and meets this couple. And straight away he tweaks that something's a bit strange about the two of them, but he couldn't quite figure out what it was.
Yeah, I mean, we do get a good insight into Chrissy is her name. Yeah, I think we get a good insight into this Ewan character because he kind of straight away clocks Chrissy as, in his words, damaged goods. You know, she's got...
Yeah, he seems like a bit of a social predator.
He definitely, I think he gets turned on by the weak. You know, he wants to violate them further, if you like.
In many possible ways.
Absolutely. You know, he sees marks on her arm. He knows them as basically heroin, you know, abuse, train tracks, but also marks from self-harm. So, yeah, let's say he has no interest in her from a physical point of view. He doesn't find her attractive. In fact, he finds her quite repulsive, again, by his own words. But he sets out to seduce her, I think
there's something about the barman he didn't like.
Yeah.
He just tipped him over the edge and made him want to.
Yeah, he as much wants to do it, to get in with Chrissy just to piss off the barman who's called Richard as it is to, you know, further damage Chrissy, as I say, in a more sinister way. He also sees the fact that, you know, she is kind of outwardly confident, even though she's clearly not so, you know, inwardly. He sees that as a challenge to break her further, which again kind of notes to his sinister attitude. He just wants to chip away at her very self-worth, I think, and, you know, just for his own cynical amusement and gratification. We're kind of treated to his horrible description of this woman's appearance as well. She's losing a battle to middle age and being overweight, in his words. But there's an exchange here between himself and Richard when Chrissy is out of the scene for a minute, where, you know, Richard is a Dutch native and he mentions that the British oppressed the Dutch in South Africa, putting them in concentration camps, and that it was the British who invented concentration camps and not the Nazis, which was an interesting historical fact I didn't know. But, you know, Ewan doesn't even bother to correct him that he's, you know, he's Scottish, not British. But instead, he actually has the kind of inner opinion that the Scottish oppressed themselves by being obsessed with the British, which is quite reminiscent of the opinions of Renton in Trainspotting as well, I think. There's a reference then to the title of the story from Chrissy, who says that Ewan is just Eurotrash like them. Everyone in Amsterdam is just scum washed up into the dustbin of Eurotrash.
Well, in fairness, these trees seem to fit that quite happily, in fairness.
Yeah, well, I think Ewan does, certainly at this point, but... You know, Richard is beaten and Ewan starts a brief relationship with Chrissy, and we're then treated to a kind of graphic account of their first time they had sex, which is anal sex, because Chrissy has badly damaged her genitals, apparently, during a sex game with a girlfriend of hers involving bottles.
These things happen, you know?
Yes. But there's also a thought by Ewan at this point, which is really an intrusive thought, that are these pop up quite frequently with Irvin Welsh, you know, and Ewan gets the image that if he was to have vaginal sex with Chrissy, his penis would be cut to ribbons by broken glass that's still up there, which, you know, is just classic Irvin Welsh imagery, I think. But eventually he ends the relationship, and I think this leads...
He just leaves. He just never sees her again, basically, for a while.
Yeah, yeah. He just, you know, he has his phone after a couple of weeks, wherever, and that's it. But I think we see a dramatic change in the storyline then, certainly from his point of view. There's this... There's this miraculous change of character in him. In his own words, you know, he's feeling physically and more mentally stronger, more prepared to open up and ready to cast aside the impregnable cloak of bitterness. He's off the heroin for a moment.
I think that might have helped.
Yes, possibly so. So his outlook on life is looking a lot brighter. He gets himself a job. He moves out of Robbie's flat, and he gets himself a new and certainly more grounded girlfriend in a girl called Anna. But this also leads to the downward spiral of Chrissy as well, and she does confront him quite aggressively in front of Anna and the barman Richard. And then
just one more kick in the hole from a long line of kicks in the holes.
Yeah,
you can imagine.
Absolutely. And eventually this leads to her being found dead in the canal. So Ewan, I think, is guilt-ridden by this.
Yes. Which I found a bit strange, considering the way he'd acted previously.
Well, this is it. This is where the kind of dramatic change in his character comes into play. You know, we see a real change in the tone of the story almost. It's still a very tragic story, but it doesn't have that sinister angle that it had at the start. He has a confrontation with your man Richard, you know, who blames him for her death, but they make up again, so everything's kind of rosy there. And then himself and Anna travel to the island of Jersey for Chrissy's funeral, and that's when we learn the kind of twist in the story here.
A little bit of a surprise, all right.
Yes, it's revealed that Chrissy was in fact born a man called Christopher. So this is obviously a shock to Ewan, and it's probably meant as a shock to the audience as well. But the story ends then with the barman Richard remembering that him and Chrissy actually didn't think of themselves as Euro trash, just people trying to get by. So I think it kind of ends on a sad note, but, you know, not as sinister as it had been.
Yeah, I think it was leading in one way, which is something big was going to happen, but then it sort of ended in a bit of a damn squib.
Yeah, a little bit, actually. I mean, as I say,
it seemed that Ewan was, for some reason, had it in for these two and was going to do something major, but it ended up he just ended up shagging her and then leaving her, and then that was it. And then it ended the way it did, like.
I think when I read this first in the mid-90s, I might have been shocked by the big reveal. But even though by this time, you know, in the mid-90s, we had the film The Crying Game out. That came out in 1992. Now, it's possible Welch wrote this story before that film was released, but it's a similar kind of twist. But I think really the point of the story is this development in the character of Ewan, you know, the change for the better in his character. But that's Eurotrash. The next story is entitled Stoke Newington Blues, and it's actually about Ewan again. And I'm not sure whether this is meant to be set before Eurotrash or after, because he's back on heroin.
Certainly is.
And he's back from Amsterdam in the UK. He's back in London. And, you know, he makes his way to a squat of a dealer that he knows. This is a black guy, a black dealer called Don. When he goes to the flat, he meets another heroin addict. She's called Ange. And she tells him a story that she's just been recently raped by a group of men who are going around the area and doing this to women. But Ewan thinks he's heard this story before, so I suppose he kind of doubts her here. But either way, Don comes back, and then suddenly the flat is raided by the police and they're all taken into custody. Actually, there's one little note here that I noticed. Ewan notices that Don is starting to look paler, you know, for a black man. And he thinks that, you know, Michael Jackson spent a fortune on trying to achieve this look, when all he had to really do was take up heroin. You know, they're brought to a notorious police station called Stoke Newington, and this kind of puts the fear of God into them, because they know the story of a black man called Earl Barrett who was battered to death in this police station.
So it doesn't look good for Don.
No, definitely not. And sure enough, when they get there, they're assaulted by both police and fellow detainees alike. And this is before Ewan is brought to a room for questioning. He's assaulted further. But then he's actually given the chance to leave, and he's even given the chance to take some heroin with him if he just signs on a dotted line to say that Don is actually a big time dealer, which is kind of all the cops wanted from the raid. They just wants to get a big collar, even if it's a made up one. What did you think of Ewan at this point? You know, the decision he makes, he kind of.
Yeah, I knew that's what he was going to do.
Yeah.
In fairness. It's a grim old tale about junkies, in fairness. There's nothing nice or glamorous about the life, and this really shows it.
No, definitely not.
They'll stab each other in the back for anything. They'll rob the eye out of your head if they had to.
Yeah, as Swanee said in Trainspotting to Renton, you know, nae friends in this game, just associates. But he takes the heroin and leaves, and he meets Ange outside. So she's obviously done the exact same thing.
Of course.
They kind of point the finger at each other, but then, you know, realize that they're both as bad as each other. And they meet a group of demonstrators outside as well, who are speaking on behalf of the mistreatment of black people in these jails, police stations, including obviously the dead man Earl Barrett. And Ewan tries to tell them about Don, you know, that there's a black man being held in there at the moment unfairly, but they take exception to this because, you know, they're only interested in speaking out for innocent men. Don is far from innocent, being a drug dealer. But the story ends with Ewan just getting the hell out of there and promising to stay clear of Hackney in future for the more favourable area of Shepherd's Bush, apparently. But I think, in fairness, it's a powerful little tale. I mean, it's speaking on the huge problem of racial inequality you know, which of course is still relevant 25 years later and was relevant for many years.
Yeah, I thought that was a good story. I thought it could have been fleshed out a bit more. It could have been a longer one. It would have been better than some of the...
Well, I actually thought the fact that it was set in London, and again, it's, you know, a Scottish guy in London, this could have even been a story involving Mark Renton that was in Trainspotting at some point. And, you know, it's... You can see where this was written around the same time, but it obviously speaks as well on the issue of police corruption, which again is all too familiar, you know, these days as well, and the betrayal of friendship, as we mentioned. The next story is a bit more upbeat, I think, and surreal. It's called VAT 96. You know, it's much more lighthearted and it's quite short. It's told in a first person narrative by an unnamed husband who, along with his wife Valerie, reluctantly agree to go for dinner at a friend's house, Fiona and Keats, who they usually find crushing bores. But things are a bit different this time when they get there.
He's dead. Well, his body's dead, but his head is in a is in a tank on the table.
Yes, it's very technical, very strange.
And Fiona is just a horrible, horrible person, really.
I just found her a bit almost kind of ditzy. I didn't really think of her as a horrible person, but now that you mention it, yes, I almost think she does things without thinking more so than being malicious. But yeah,
I'd say she's just thinking about herself, really.
Oh, she's definitely doing that. So yeah, I mean, she explains that, you know, Keaty Wheaty, as she calls him, a bit of bad news on the Keaty Wheaty front. That, you know, his car, a tire blew out on him on the motorway, and he ran face first or head on into an Arctic truck. So yeah, that it's obviously set perhaps in the near future, a dystopian future, if you like, where the insurance company were able to put them in touch with some German company that were experimenting with keeping heads alive while they look for suitable bodies to attach to them. So this is why we get this kind of Futurama effect with Keith's head in a basically a fish tank at the end of the sitting room. I did like a couple of lines in it. You know, Fiona, first of all, when she says, I know, you're wondering how we can afford this, to which the narrator replies, actually, I was wondering what happened to Keith. And then Fiona is running around, you know, in and out of the kitchen. The narrator, his wife, is about to reply, will you sit down? You're running around like a headless chicken, but manages to stop herself and change it to Blue Horse Fly at the last moment. And the host also refuses a glass of wine because he's driving home, and then kind of mouths an apology to Keith. I like the fact that Keith's only real form of communication is to wink.
A lot of winking going on.
Yeah, he winks hello and he winks goodbye. And then, you know, we have the last kind of laugh at the end of the story where Fiona, this is again where she's kind of thinking of herself.
Tell her about her wonderful new man.
Yes, she's found a new man who meets her sexual needs, you know, which has obviously gone out the door as far as Keith's concerned.
And he's struggling in that department.
Struggling to keep it up. But she mentions that only last week, the new man in her life is the guy from the insurance firm as well, coincidentally. But only last week, he swept her off her feet and took her there right in the sitting room. And it finishes with a couple of lines where she remarks, do you think Keith's his tank would look better over the far side of the room beside the CD unit? And the narrator, noticing that Keith's view is right in front of the CD, reckons that, yes, he definitely would like to be moved. But I think it's just a very funny, lighthearted story, obviously with a bit of black humour, which I think probably lends itself more to Black Mirror than, say, The Twilight Zone. So Irvine Welsh, a bit ahead of the times there, I think.
Certainly.
Okay, next up is a story called The Soft Touch. Obviously, this is one of the three stories that was chosen for the film, which we will talk about in the future. But it's about a man called John. Who,
born loser.
Well, definitely a soft touch, as in the title. He meets up with his ex, Katrina. We learn that they have a daughter together, which he rarely sees and she never sees. The child is cared for by John's mother, and he notices that Katrina is in the family way once again, and he kind of notes that, you know, she has no time for children, but she loves being pregnant, so I presume for the attention that brings. You know, he reveals that he doesn't see his own child Chantel very much, but he kind of pathetically justifies this to himself by claiming that, well, you know, a mother really who abandons his child is much worse than a father who does it, which is a strange logic. But, you know, we learn then that the daughter is the third child of Katrina that she has abandoned, and that John didn't even know about these two other children at their wedding.
charming lady.
Absolutely. You know, he reveals that their relationship was somewhat strained right from the get-go. You know, she drinks heavily, or always did, and he'd often catch her laughing at him behind his back, or often not even behind his back, you know, with her sisters or members of her family. She has a bit, comes from a bit of a notorious family from the area.
Doyles, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nutbags. Notorious nutbags around the place. So you wouldn't mess with the Doyles, basically. Her brothers would keep the show there.
Yeah, and John kind of thinks that that's, you know, going to go in his favour.
It's going to bode well for him. He's got a bit of protection.
Absolutely.
No one's going to fuck with him now.
Far from it, unfortunately. But, you know, we hear from him through flashbacks or whatever that, you know, he used to give her money to go out and enjoy herself, and he'd stay in and mind the child. And then she would come home with more money than she went out with, suspiciously, and covered with love bites, no less. So obviously engaging in some prostitution, I denoted from that.
I would imagine so. That's getting paid for love bites.
Absolutely. But before you feel too sorry for John, it's also revealed that he wanted to, in his own words, check her fanny to see if she'd been shagging, which is quite barbaric. And, you know, it was obviously ludicrously misogynist behaviour for any man to engage in. John's other big problem, as he said, is Katrina's family, the Doyles, notorious criminals in the area. And, you know, he's even made mind drugs for one of the brothers at one point, you know, serious class A drugs as well.
The only thing about that is they may have used them, but they didn't beat the shit out of him, which wasn't a bad thing.
No,
they didn't
beat him up. No, they do. It's mentioned that they do beat him up at one point, but we'll get to that. Oh. So he moved, you know, they've moved in together, as you say, into a lavish new pad. And upstairs is a chap called Larry, who, in John's words, is a bigger nutter possibly than the Doyles, and certainly one of the few guys on the scheme that the Doyles gave respect to. But what did you think about Larry?
Larry's a good lad. Nice and friendly to start off with, but then it changed a little bit.
Yes.
But he could spot, once again, he could spot that John was a soft touch, and straight away he went in for a kill.
Yeah, took advantage of it. I mean, Katrina blatantly just moves in upstairs with Larry, you know, leaving John to look after Chantel. And he basically proceeds to ransack John's flat then, you know, of anything valuable, or at least valuable for the early 90s. He brings a cable through the floor and demands that John plugs it in so he can use his electricity, because, well, his has been cut off. Yeah. So, you know, it stands to reason he'd want to take John's. And when John protests at this kind of unbelievably brazen act, he's obviously threatened with a severe beating. And the irony in this as well, of course, is that John's electricity bill was pretty low at that point anyway, because he'd no appliances in his house to use.
Well, Larry had them all, friends.
Absolutely.
And then, like the way Larry described the sexual encounters he was having with John's wife, Katrina.
Yeah, he's very gentlemanly here, all right, describing Katrina's kind of sexual prowess. Yeah, I mean, he's complimenting Katrina with a wink, of course, and he actually hopes that John doesn't have AIDS, because at this point he's had unprotected sex with Katrina himself, obviously.
Anal sex, obviously, because he doesn't want to get her pregnant.
No, exactly. And he finishes off by pointing out that he's actually doing John a favour, because he doesn't want a barn around his house, so John gets to keep Chantel, which he should be grateful for.
He's all hard, really.
Absolutely. And he also offers John the opportunity to have sex with Katrina again, obviously for at a price, a tenner. But, John
refuses, surprisingly.
He does, yes. Well, this is the straw that broke the camel's back for John. You know, he makes the decision to take his baby to his mother's house. But his mother then unfortunately phones social services, which leads to, you know, John getting beatings for grassing up the Doyles, essentially. He gets another severe beating from Larry when John's electricity is cut off, which means Larry doesn't have electricity again. But it all comes to a head when Katrina and Larry get evicted, apparently, from the upstairs flat, and John is left in peace for a while, or at least until Katrina walks back into his life in this fine establishment here. But she reveals that Larry's back in prison.
She's pregnant again.
She's pregnant again with Larry's baby, but she convinces John to get back with her, you know.
I don't think he needed much.
No, it doesn't sound like it. He admits that he never stopped loving her. So we're kind of left with a really heartwarming love story here.
Pretty much.
Which is probably all too alike real life for a lot of people, I think. Even the electricity pilfering, you know, I thought this was possibly a bit far-fetched, but then again, maybe not. Nothing surprises me. But as I say, this is one of the three stories from the movie. Yeah, so let's move on to the next one. The next story is called The Last Resort on the Adriatic. So again, it's told in the first-person narrative, and it's an older gentleman who's taking a cruise alone, and all he seems to do is wander around the cruise ship all day aimlessly, expecting to see someone called Joan jump out of him. Not jump out, that makes her sound like some sort of Michael Myers type figure, but just he expects to see this woman Joan at every turn, and he doesn't. He goes to the gym a lot on the boat as well.
Pumping iron
indeed. And I noticed
the fittest man on the boat,
I would say, so even for at his age. Yes. You know, he sounds middle-aged, at least middle-aged to older. But he actually robs some weights from the gym. You know, he puts them in a sports bag when he's leaving, and then it's revealed that this woman Joan is his wife, who actually died 10 years previously on the very same boat. She apparently fell overboard after taking some depression medication, and it's revealed that their kids are grown up and have moved away as well. So this man is very much on his own, but he does manage to score after dinner one night.
One last hurrah.
Absolutely. He's the perfect gentleman and starts off as a very considerate lover as well by the sounds of things, but ruins it all by calling this other woman Joan while in the throes of passion. So he apologizes and explains basically that he's just a one-woman man before leaving. And later that very same night, then he actually mails a videotape to his kids, kind of explaining, you know, what his actions are going to be. And he leaves a little note for this woman as well, Marianne, I believe her name was, explaining that he really only came on the boat for one reason. And then it ends on a pretty tragic note where he basically weighs himself down with these gym weights and slowly jumps overboard. You know, it takes a while. Given his age, it takes him a while to make his way overboard. But off he goes. And, you know, I think it's probably an effective, it's a short story, but it is an effective one in terms
it's
of...
It's a pretty real life story, because there is a lot of people who just can't deal with grief, loss and grief.
Absolutely, yeah.
You find the one love in their life and that's it, nothing else. Once they're gone, that's what you find with a lot of couples. They've been married years, one dies and within a year the other one is dead.
Yeah. Yeah, can't live without them. Yeah. Absolutely. So we're seeing a shift in themes here in terms of, you know, stories that are funny, stories that are tragic, and stories that are kind of disturbing. The next one is literally a quartet of very short stories. It's called The Sexual Disaster Quartet. These are all one page or less than. The first one is entitled The Good Son, and it basically just explains that the main character worships his mother. And simply could not, but he simply could not make love to her, at least not with the father in the room watching. And as he leaves,
which is understandable.
Absolutely, yeah. That's, I would feel the very same way, I think. But as he leaves the room, the father remarks, "Ah, Oedipus, you're a complex fucker, right enough." So just a short little parody on, you know, an ancient Greek tragedy. And I was actually reminded once again of Mark Renton, because in Trainspotting, it is noted by one of his psychiatrists that he may have Oedipal feelings towards his mother, quite disturbingly. But the next story in the quartet then is called The Cruel Bastard and the Selfish Fucker, which basically tells the story of a man and a woman meeting one night. She's highly insulting and he just doesn't care. All he cares about is getting pissed. This leads to their first sexual encounter, where she again insults his manhood, asking him who he plans to satisfy with that thing, to which he replies himself. But this leads to them living together, and everyone around them seems to think that it's working out fine. So
it's a modern day romance.
Absolutely. That sounds like a pretty good account of a lot of real life relationships right there. The next story is entitled Lots of Laughter and Sex. which is a really short kind of inner thought of a man who remembers his partner's theory that both of these things, laughter and sex, are essential in a relationship, to which he agrees, but just not at the same time, cunt.
No.
So again, a fairly accurate complaint there for some real people, I think. And the last one is, I think, my favourite of the four stories. It's entitled Robert K. Lard, A Sexual History, and it's literally just one sentence. It's a Rab's never had a ride in his puff. Poor wee cunt. Doesn't he seem too bothered, mind you? So very sensible of Robert, I think, there, not to worry about such trivial things.
Whatever keeps you going.
So we've, again, another change in atmosphere, I think, with the next story. It's entitled Snuff.
It's very dark, this one, isn't it?
Yes, it's a dark tale. It's about a man called Ian Smith, who has basically spent the last year of his life doing nothing except going to work and then watching massive amounts of movies when he gets home.
Just to fill out a...
Yeah, what is it? It's
the Halliwell's Film Guide.
Yes, which sounds like it must have been a kind of a printed version of IMDb before the internet. But he's watching a whole range of films. He's renting between 2 and 4 videos every night, as well as having a satellite subscription, which would have been kind of new and fancy in the early 90s when this came out. And he's also a member of smaller, more exclusive film clubs, which rent out rare foreign or pornographic productions. So he's covering all bases here. He's a complete loner in work. He's actually known as the video kid behind his back. But yeah, it's
he
a very...
Care. Has no interest in people.
No, whatsoever. He really doesn't. It sounds like he did, you know, this isn't a new thing in the last year either. It's revealed that he had a wife who, surprise, surprise, left him because she found him quite boring. I'm amazed that she married him in the first place. But I suppose it is revealed that he has one thing going for him. He is incredibly well endowed.
Mad like a donkey.
And this was the only thing, obviously, that this woman had going in for her in this relationship. She did enjoy the sex with him.
He could make her orgasm every time they had sex.
Several times, apparently.
Several times, whatever.
And never climaxed himself.
Couldn't be arsed.
And his only real response to her announcing that she was leaving was to be excited about the fact that he could finally get the satellite dish put in.
It's all about priorities, you know?
Yeah. He even stops visiting his parents, you know, which is actually secretly a relief to them because his visits were uncomfortable silences. It's a bad sign when your parents are uncomfortable around you. But, you know, he's even stopped answering the front door, and this leads to him ignoring his own brother, who was coming to tell him that his mother had had a stroke and actually had just died. So he missed that as well. And he goes for a funeral, but quickly slopes off just to go home and watch more films. And there's kind of this good reference here by Welch where he just writes that Ian Smith's conscious thoughts, dreams, and the passive viewing of his TV all eventually gelled into one. So he even starts taking speed that he gets off a dealer, you know, in one of the flats near him, just so he can stay up longer and watch more films. All with the aim of finishing this Halliwell's Film Guide. It's at this point, did you notice there's a couple of news articles that he noticed, which kind of put an even darker twist on things?
Yeah, there was one, two pretty dark stories. One about a 6-year-old girl who got kidnapped.
Yeah.
And another about an 18-year-old boy. Man, we just got a random attack, beaten, put into ICU.
Yeah, and I kind of wondered at this point, was Ian Smith actually involved in these? Yeah, because the girl's kidnapping comes up a couple of times.
Yeah, we never really get to find out.
No, we don't. But we do learn that he does eventually he completes the Halliwell's Film Guide.
His life is complete.
Yeah, he's kind of lost after this. The last film that he scores is Three Men and a Little Lady.
It could be another reference to the Child Gone Missing, which is disturbing as well.
Absolutely. And it's apparently the first film that he gave a 0 score to. I can think of a lot worse films than Three Men and a Little Lady, but I wouldn't argue with a 0 score for that either, really. But yeah, the story ends on a very dark note. It's him hanging himself in his living room while watching it himself. On a video camera that he's hooked up above his TV, so he's basically able to watch himself. Yeah, and I found it interesting. At one point, he tries to scream "cut" as if that's got to stop everything. That kind of reminded me of a bit in The Running Man, where I think it was Dynamo was taken out by Schwarzenegger and started screaming "cut the commercial, cut the commercial." But this is real life here as well, as was The Running Man, of course, very much real life, You know, he dies, he hangs himself. So it's a very disturbing and tragic tale here. I actually got a bit of a Dennis Nielsen vibe off this character, purely because of his kind of destined loneliness and his reclusive habits. And
happy with his loneliness.
Yeah, definitely so.
A lot of people lonely people long for
company,
but companionship, but no, not this fella.
Yeah, I suppose he's probably different to Dennis Nielsen. He's even worse than Dennis Nielsen in that regard. So, but
Well, if he killed the child, he definitely is.
Yes, yes. So the next story is entitled "A Blockage in the System." It's basically about three council tradesmen, Colm, Losey, and the narrator, who are playing cards, shooting the breeze one morning when their supervisor, Noxie, comes in and informs them that there's a serious disaster down at a local block of flats that needs to be attended to. He goes into some detail that basically the blockage has accumulated in a poor old man's ground floor flat, basically from the 20 stories above him. So in Welsh's words, yes, in Welsh's words, it's a weekend's worth of curries and lager, which is built up in this man's toilet.
And surprisingly enough, for three council workers, they didn't seem too interested in doing anything about it.
No, they definitely don't. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing here. They, you know, are pushing back. They're saying that it sounds like it should be another department from the region. But their boss, Noxie, is insistent here. You know, he's reminding them that if they don't do the work, they won't get future contracts. But again, they're pushing back, kind of bringing up the union card. And basically,
there ain't no way they're working.
Yeah. Basically implying that they can't be sacked, you know, because they work for the council. It sounds like they have a hard time taking orders from this guy, Noxie, who was, you know, maybe at one point was a mate of theirs. But he's kind of gotten a bit tougher. As Welsh writes, you know, he's gone on a supervisor's course, so he's more like a Nazi these days. But he eventually, you know, talks them into at least heading down to size up the situation. And it's just as bad as predicted.
If not worse.
Yes, the smell apparently is beyond terrible. And even though they don't actually go into the bathroom of the old man, you can kind of imagine that it's a bit like the elevator scene out of The Shining, but with shite instead of blood.
But it's a lot of shite.
Absolutely. But Noxie continues to argue with them despite their protests. You know, they're still insisting that this is a job for another department who would deal with the drains outside of the house, and they don't have the tools to deal with this job from the inside. They're kind of really painting a bad picture of the scene for Noxie by saying that it's probably clogged up with used nappies and sanitary pads. And their argument, I liked the little section here where their argument draws attention from a social worker who was there to kind of calm down the old man. And she gives them a scorpy look. And I like the narrator's thoughts here. She's saying she's not very social for a social worker, which is a bit like a lifeguard that can't swim. But eventually Noxie just loses the head with him and tells him to fuck off and he'll deal with it himself, which is obviously a complete result for these lads.
Perfect. That's exactly what they wanted.
And there's only thing that this calls for them.
Points.
Absolutely. So they're momentarily worried that this will mean they get their cards from the DLO. But one of them, Lousy, I don't know how to pronounce this man's name, he remarks that the only cards the council hand out come in packs of 52. And, you know, he does suggest that they go for a drink. And I loved the narrator's reply here. I'm going to have to try and use this at some point in life. Why not? He says, if you're going to get done for stealing a sheep, you may as well shag it and all. So they reassure themselves that they gave their professional opinion. And at the end of the day, that's the most important skill in any trade, is accurate problem diagnosis. So I liked this story. I mean,
that was good. Lighthearted, the story.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as you say, it's comically playing on the age-old theory that council workers are lazy.
Theory.
Well, it's just a theory, yeah.
Yeah, obviously. Sorry.
And it kind of brings up the kind of topical subject as well of trade unions, which would have been a major part of, you know, working class areas in around this time, obviously during or pre-Thatcher era in Britain. And it's followed by another fun little story and a strange story at that, entitled Wayne Foster.
No way.
So yeah, this is a weird one. It's kind of surrealism. It's set in a pub in Leith, but the two characters that we meet first seem to be some sort of weird bird people.
Sparryhead.
So this is obviously a term for Hearts fans, a local term I can only assume. It's not one I'm familiar with. So I'm assuming this is a not so thinly veiled insult by Irvine Welsh to Hearts fans.
Scum of the earth.
Yeah.
In his eyes, yes.
So you get this kind of surreal image of these two bird men sitting in a pub arguing over an incident at the match they've just been to. Seemingly there was a row, and one of them thinks that this is down to Hibs casuals infiltrating the Hearts ground. I don't know what Hearts ground is called.
Castle.
Okay. I know Easter Road is Hibs, but and the other guy is saying, no, this was down to Hearts fans arguing over how good Wayne Foster is as a footballer.
How shit he was.
How shit, yeah. Do you remember Wayne Foster?
I don't, actually.
Yeah, so Wayne Foster is an English footballer that obviously played for Hearts in the late 80s and early 90s. And there seems to be kind of dissension in the ranks as to whether he was a good asset or not. And I liked the description here that the men were arguing so vigorously that there was feathers falling from their heads onto the ground of the pub as they waved their beaks in disagreement. But it seems like Wayne Foster was a fast player, but not very skillful, but, you know, made up for it in speed and therefore a credit to the team. And I can only assume that this became a kind of a boring character trait of Hearts fans around this time that everyone else has picked up on, because these two characters keep repeating Wayne Foster, like some sort of chant. But needless to say, they end up, they're getting refused in the pub. I'm assuming this is because they're Hearts fans. And the story kind of shifts then to the attention of the barman, who is
known as the classical scholar.
Yes, he's definitely overqualified for this job, and this is one of the kind of problems he has with his life, that he's resorted to having to serve or refuse sparry heads, Hearts fans in this pub. But he's also put off by the fact that there's two women in the bar looking over at him and taking the piss out of him. And he has history of both of these women.
Yes, we find out he has a bit of history. We never find out what.
Well, slightly. He's referring to one as she, and he really likes her. He apparently got fellatio off her the previous New Year's Eve.
Well, in fairness, he's definitely going to like her then.
Yeah. That's definitely a quality that would endear you to somebody.
Certainly would.
But she doesn't want to know him ever since. And the other woman he refers to as her. And he doesn't want to know her. He has had sexual relations with her in the past, but he doesn't like seeing the two of these women together. That spells trouble for him.
Plotting against them.
They're plotting against him, and he can clearly see that they're, you know, insulting his manhood by holding up their fingers. But there's a weird scene here then. It gets really weird, actually. He goes to the toilet. He's obviously really getting worked up by, you know, refusing the sparry heads and seeing these two women take the piss out of him. He goes to the toilet and takes a bite out of a filthy bar of soap and just chews on it for a while, and then starts beating his one fist into his other palm and humming a mantra, slags, 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 which seems to have a calming effect on him after a while. And he's able to return to the bar and be much more professional and sternly tell the sparry heads that, you know, well, he doesn't even tell them anything. He just ignores them. We get reminded of the golden rules of bar work when relating to sparry heads. Number one, act decisively. Number two, remain implacably in control of that initial decision, irrespective of whether that decision is just or not. And number three, never attempt to explain to the sparry head the reasons for your decision by justifying or rationalizing. You merely compromise your authority.
Very true.
Yes, great. It possibly works for all areas of bar work, really. But this impresses the woman known as She, that he likes, so much that she comes over and remarks that she likes the way he dealt with those weird beaky guys with the feathered faces. And she actually invites him back then to her flat with her friend Rosaline, who is the other woman, which he knows.
Her.
Her, yes.
Not Ben, her.
But she, Ben. But she says to him then, understand, Craig, we won't fuck you. You'll get nothing off us. You're quite a sexy man, but you take yourself far too seriously. We want to show you something about yourself. So we're left, the classic scholar is left wondering what this is, and we are as well. But he says he will go anyway. It could be enlightening. And it doesn't matter whether you're a sparry head or a classical scholar. There's always lessons to be learned in life. So what the fuck was all that about, James?
He wants to ride no matter what he says. The two women invite him back. No matter what he thinks of them, he's going back.
Yeah, he's going to basically be talked into anything at this stage, isn't he?
No matter how highly he thinks of himself.
Yes.
It's the same as the rest of the dirty dogs in the world.
He certainly is. And we can only assume the sparry heads never got their round of drinks either.
Let's hope not.
Much to the amusement of Irvin Welsh. That's pretty weird. It's about to get weirder because the next story is called When the Debris Meets the Sea.
This is one of the strangest ones in it, all right.
Yes. So we're brought out of Scotland. We're at a lavish Santa Monica mansion on the beach here. And there's four women lounging around. Three of them are oogling over men in a magazine while the fourth is watching a TV show. Nothing too strange about that. That kind of sounds like, you know, a modern day show like The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills or something like that. But then you learn that the four women are Kylie Minogue, Victoria Principal, Madonna, and Kim Basinger. Straight off, they're not four people, I imagine, being two pally together.
I don't imagine that.
They're also speaking in thick Scottish accents.
Plus the men they're ogling over are
elite superstars, yes. The magazines that they're reading have names such as Wido, Scheme Scene, and Bevy Merchants. And Kim Basinger is watching a documentary about a chap called Dodie Chalmers, who owns an American pit bull and works as a removals man. And he's actually speaking on this documentary about his job and his drinking habits, like a celeb would speak about how they've just recorded a hit album or wrote a best-selling novel.
She's getting juiced up by it.
She really is, as Kim Basinger can get juiced up. And the other three women are looking up names such as Deke Prentice from Gilmartin, a former Hibs casual, and Tam McKenzie from the youth lead team. So I'd say they're oogling over these guys. And Kim seems to be the only one with an ounce of sense. She's kind of telling them that they're never going to know these guys. They're out of their league.
Way big time.
Yeah. There's some brilliant remarks here, like Kylie Minogue, just, you know, oh, look at the package on that content. It's just really fucking bizarre. You know, they're lusting after the bulges in these men's shiny tracksuits and their tattoos. And they're speaking of hopefully traveling to Leeds someday to meet them. And Kim Basinger points out that this is a pipe dream and it's never going to happen. I like that Madonna was even singing about going on a holiday to the tune of her hit song Holiday. It just ends with all of them knowing in their hearts that this is never going to happen for them. So it's really weird. I suppose it's just a strange role reversal story.
It's just a take on modern life for people.
Yeah.
People look at celebrities as if they're something special.
Yeah.
Normal like the rest of us.
Absolutely. And I suppose it just highlights the kind of ridiculous over-the-top sexualization of these celebs sometimes. And dare I say, misogynist fantasy talk that goes on probably primarily between men, but possibly to a lesser degree women as well. And the next story is a tad bit strange as well, or at least ends that way. It's called Granny's Old Junk. So what did you make of this one, James?
It's another classic junkie tale.
Yeah.
all seem going well with a young fella.
Yeah, he's Craig Abercrombie.
Yeah, strange name.
Yeah.
Strange name. And then visiting his grandmother, Mrs.
Abercrombie.
Abercrombie, yeah. For you to say.
It kind of reads almost again like a little extract from Trainspotting. You know, it's not unlike something that would have gone on in that book.
You get a sense of the story. You think you know what's going to happen.
Mm.
What you think is going to happen does happen, but then it gets twisted right at the end.
Yeah, so he goes to visit his granny and she's wary of him because she's heard from his mother that he's on drugs, but he reassured her that this isn't the case. And he's kind of on the way there. He's, you know, justifying what he's going to do by saying, well, some of the money might end up being his anyway. And it'd actually be perverse not to rob her.
Yeah, he's got to rob his own grandmother.
Yes, and he'd hate to leave it for somebody else to rob.
Yeah, true.
But, it goes a bit turn for the worse then, or strange, when he nips off to go to the toilet, but actually sneaks into her room, grabs her biscuit tin. That's not a euthanism. Yeah, when he opens up the tin, it's revealed that it actually has a massive bag of heroin in it. He's obviously shocked by this, and then his granny reveals that her husband had been in the Merchant Navy and came back with a habit and had contacts at the docks, so they've always had a steady supply of heroin, and she picked up the habit herself and now has to sell to young people in the area to feed her own habit. But this has brought suspicion from the woman who runs the old folks' home. So this is where this character, Graham, can't remember his name.
Craig,
steps in to offer his services to help as a dealer. And this works out great for both of them. And they no doubt celebrate it straight afterwards with a shot of heroin each.
Blood is always thicker than water, you know.
Yes. it's a weird ending to it. Very strange. Possibly a bit far-fetched to think that a grandmother in whatever age she is in an old folks home was able to keep a steady heroin habit for many decades. But That's craziness, and that's where we've drifted into in the Acid House. The next story then, another strange one. It's called The House of John Deff. This is, well, possibly a lot less far-fetched, but nonetheless peculiar story. Again, told in the first-person narrative by a man who recalls a boy that he knew growing up. simply known as John Deaf. He was called John and he was deaf, but this was also apparently because of the way he introduced himself to people. Basically, all he would say is John Deaf, meaning my name is John and I am deaf. So John Deaf lives in an almost derelict house with his grandfather, who apparently is also deaf. The house is completely void of furniture, bar a chair for the granddad who sits there watching telly all day. But it's overrun with white mice, which John Deaf apparently has a bit of a fascination with, not just because he loves them so much, but also to basically be cruel to for his own amusement. He's hurting these left, right, and center, stepping on them. One mouse in particular is going around just pulling itself around by its back legs because it's, you know, it can't do anything else. But needless to say, John Deaf is largely uneducated.
It's just a terrible story about scumbags, really.
It kind of is. I mean, he never goes to school, so this is the perfect hideout for the narrator and other characters. And they're hanging around his house, as I say, assaulting white mice.
And then his sister.
He catches his sister basically having sex with John Deaf. Or John Deaf having sex with his sister.
Tries to beat the shit out of John Deaf. John Deaf turns around and beats the shit out with him.
Yeah, it's at this point that the narrator realizes that John Deaf is probably a good few years older than him.
Yes. Most of us know people like that.
Yeah.
Kept back from school many, many years.
Yes. He reckons he's probably about 16, so I don't know what age the narrator's meant to be about here. I don't know, maybe 12, 13, something like that. But he's remarked that John Deaf was actually an asset to the local football team, both for his speed and his strength. So you can imagine what a paneling he's given him here now in the house. And there's actually a funny bit where the other people in attendance are shouting at John Deaf to leave him alone. He's had enough. But of course, John Deaf doesn't hear them and carries on. Eventually, he does get pulled away from him, and the narrator says that he made his way downstairs and maliciously assaulted this poor injured mouse yet again by stepping on it, but it doesn't kill it yet again, apparently. But seemingly John Deaf's grandfather has also taken a turn for the worst at this point and is taken into care. The narrator doesn't actually remember whether he died or was just, you know, he never came back to the house, and this resulted in John Deaf himself being taken away also. We hear then that the narrator and his sister, they don't tell their parents initially, but the parents cop that something's going on just by the kind of silence between the two.
The narrator was trying to blackmail his sister.
Yeah.
I'll tell your father that you're trying to have sex with John Deaf.
Yeah.
And when the father finds out, he doesn't take too kindly to it.
No, but he takes it out on the narrator rather than his sister. Yeah. It kind of ends then, the story ends with the narrator saying that he was never the same himself after the beating he got from John Deaf all these years later. So
you don't want a deaf man sitting there punching the head off him.
No. So it's definitely an unusual tale, but I think it probably highlights, as you say, highlights just life in certain working class areas.
Grim,
but also kind of the little or no care that people with disabilities would receive in these working class areas. And, you know, that's come up before in Irvine Welsh novels. I think it definitely comes up again. We also see another example of animal cruelty, which comes up quite frequently in Irvine Welsh novels. Okay, the next story is called Across the Hall, and I quite like this one. It's another short story, but it's also an early example, I think, of Irvine Welsh's kind of experimenting with his style of writing, or at least the writing format, because what we get here is kind of a split-screen effect with two conversations. On one side, you get a first-person narrative of a woman she starts off just with bullshit, small talk. You know, she's explaining to someone that she's more than a glorified typist and has big career plans, but she's sort of a feminist as well. Before her talk quickly turns to flirting and finally just pure sex chat, I think it's fair to say, that kind of descends into orgasmic moaning on her part. And then while on the other side of the page, running concurrently with this, is a man who, again, starts off with more bullshit, kind of chit-chat about a business colleague. You can kind of picture him sitting, you know, in a restaurant or whatever, talking to this woman, just talking shite to her. He starts complimenting her then, and then gets promptly more forward and flirty before ending it with a very happy climax himself. What do you think of this one?
This is a good story. It's a good look into, he's taking a look at people in general. where it's sort of unrequited lust love, where there's someone that you like, and it's the sort of things that are going on in your head, and possibly on the other side they're thinking the same thing, but the two of them never get the courage to do anything about it.
Yeah, they never act on it. Yeah.
So it's like, it's a bit like a peep show again, where one person's talking, one way, one person, you just never know what someone else is thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in fairness, all one of them had to say was one thing, and it would have worked there for the two.
Yeah.
Said nothing. I'm sure this goes on everywhere.
Oh, definitely.
All over the world.
I reckon so. I mean, it's very clever the way he then goes, as you say, he goes back to normal text, and it's revealed that the woman is called Stephanie and the man Frank. They do know each other, but certainly not as lovers. They're just shy neighbours passing each other in this, I presume, apartment complex, and they're too nervous to say anything to each other in real life, bar talk about the weather. So, yeah, it's a clever little story about loneliness and the lack of confidence, as you say, in people that can kind of stifle their chances of fucking happiness, really.
But then again, if you act on every time that happens to you.
Yeah, but sometimes you just have to go for it.
I suppose you do. You've got to get them fingers out, I suppose.
Okay, so the next story, again, is a very short one. It's entitled Lisa's Mom Meets the Queen Mom, or Mum. And it's
I really hate this story.
Yeah, well, it's just a first-person narrative of a single mother. And she's just explained. She seems a bit kind of ditzy, I don't know. Yeah, she's explaining that her young daughter was chosen to present the Queen Mother with a bouquet of flowers when she visits her school in Ilford. I don't know, where's Ilford?
London.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Much to the envy of one of her friends, you know, whose own daughter had obviously missed out. But things go badly on the big day when Lisa runs away from the Queen Mum, who was reaching in to kiss her after receiving these lovely flowers. And Lisa announces loudly to her mortified mother that old lady, I have written down here, that old lad, is that old lady had bad breath and smells of wee. So there's obviously severe embarrassment on the narrator's side here, which is only added to by her friend, you know, the jealous mother, sniggering. And she then remarks that the Queen Mother addressed her as Mr. Chamberlain. So obviously early onset of senile dementia here for the Queen Mother. But the story ends with her also revealing that Lisa had a stain down the front of her lovely dress. And when she got home, she was in big trouble because she was ever so cross with her. So she just sounds like a really boring mother, to be honest with you.
It's a terrible story.
Yeah, I think Irvine Welsh is obviously a very proud Scotsman. And as we know, he's very anti-establishment and, dare I say, an anti-monarchist. So I think this is just a fun little dig at the royal family.
And the people who love.
Yes, people who are obsessed with them indeed. But yeah, it's a two-pager, I think. Yeah, it's not great. It's not great in fairness, but the next one is entitled The Two Philosophers. So this one concerns a Scottish philosopher, Gus, who's a former student of Karl Popper, some famous philosopher, and an American guy called Lou, who prefers the works of Thomas Cohn. So they've always argued about the theories of both these great men.
Since they've known each other, they've had a lifelong disagreement, shall we say, over these two philosophers.
Absolutely. And this is all well and good when we're in the confines of, you know, a university or some sort of debate. But then it spills into the kind of normal drinking life together, which they want to stop. So the American character Lou Arnstein comes up with the idea that you need to basically enlist the opinion of a lesser than person than themselves, and whatever that person decides, you know, will settle the argument, and that'll be the end of it. So they're in Glasgow when they come up with this, and they start kind of combing the streets looking for a suitable candidate, and they wander into a pub. I think it's called the Brecon Arms or the Brecon Inn, Brecon's Bar. I was nearly there, in Govan. So it's full of Rangers fans. And they do spot a couple of old codgers playing dominoes in the corner, and they enlist their opinions on this.
It's an old firm day as well, so the tensions are senses are heightened at that stage. Tensions are heightened.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the old guys does make the opinion, you know, it's like the old guy here says, it's only names, but magic, science, what's the fucking difference? It's only names we give them. At which point, a fat youth Rangers fan says, you guys come in here with your silly wee arguments. There's only one way to settle this argument. You two in a square go outside. So things take a turn for the worse then, comically so, when the two lads are brought outside, surrounded by Rangers fans, and I was going to say forced to fight, but I think the American Lou...
American was itching first.
Yeah, he was quite happy to strike the first blow, and come on, asshole, he says to him. And off they go, two out lads beating the head off each other in a street in Govan. And this obviously draws the attention of the local police authority, who take them in. And the American guy kind of convinces the police that he's in the wrong place, you know, at the wrong time due to his accent. So he's allowed to leave. But poor old Gus is charged with a breach of peace and is kept in prison, or kept in the police station. But the story ends then. Obviously, this American guy's theory is, you know, relating to science or magic basically being undiscovered science. And it kind of ends with him being recognized in the underground by obviously one of the Rangers fans who had seen the fight. He says, "Oh, I seen you fighting that other guy. You were magic." And Lou Ornstein replies, "No, I'm unknown science." So not a great joke there at the end.
This was a good story as well. There's another look on human behavior where these two philosophers, highly intelligent, highly educated, they actually think they're better than people. But when it all boils down to it, when they have an argument, they just punch the head off each other.
Yeah, they're no better than anyone
else.
They're
no better than anyone else.
Okay, the next story is quite short. It's literally another two-pager, and it's called Disney Matter. And it's basically a man telling us about his family's trip to Disneyland in the US.
Where he punches a bear.
Basically, yes. Spoiler alert. So he's used his redundancy.
I'm only spoiling this because I don't like this one either.
In fairness, you're only going ahead about a paragraph there, but still. So yeah, they're on this trip with his wife and his girlfriend. A nice gesture on his part to use his redundancy money to do this. But an employee in Disneyland in a bear suit jumps out, obviously for entertainment purposes, but scares the child, scares the barn. But yeah, our narrator, as in his own words, panels the cunt. And he kind of becomes concerned about this because the police are called and they are armed, of course, in the US. But once the situation is explained and they see his side of things, the bear's supervisor actually tells the guy in the bear's costume that he's going to have to be sacked. At which point the narrator, in fairness,
if it was an actual bear, it would have been a lot better.
Yes, it would be a much better story and probably more fitting of the Acid House team here.
Scottish man punching a live bear would be more interesting.
But the narrator steps in, you know, to say that, look, there's no need to let the guy go. And after all, you know, it indeed doesn't matter. So, you know, all is well. The guy keeps his job and this guy and his family head on their way. But it ends with a funny line where the bear employee, obviously an American, tells the narrator to have a nice day, to which the Scottish guy thinks to himself, "I'll give you a nice day, you cunt," but decides to leave it and just says, "Yeah, you too, mate." So I suppose it's a funny image here of an elite man, very much a fish out of water, surrounded by over-enthusiastic Americans. I did actually picture Begbie in this role, and I suppose that would have been funny at this point in Begbie's life, you know, at this point in the mid-90s, because number one, he probably wouldn't have treated his family to a trip to Disneyland.
I don't think it would have ended so well for him.
No, he definitely would have. He wouldn't have been so diplomatic in handling the situation in the end. But ironically enough, in later days, Begbie, you know, in the book, The Blade Artist, is much more of a changed man and possibly would have brought his new family to Disneyland. But we'll get to that on Junk Dilemmas in due time. The next story then is entitled The Grant and Star Cause.
It's one of the better ones.
Yeah, one of the more memorable ones for sure. Again, it's another one of the stories out of the film adaptation. So what did you think of this one, Jem?
That was good. Story of Bob Coyle. Talk about having a bad day. Things go downhill fairly rapidly.
They don't
come up either.
No. He's definitely had a bad day. He's dropped by his football team, the Grant and Star.
And he washes the kit for him.
He does, but you know, they're going places.
Seriously, they're gonna be playing with nets fairly soon. Which is like, I played in some bad standards of football, but at least we've always had nets. To not have actual nets, holy fuck.
So yeah, he's dropped by the football team. He tells them to go stick it, and then he heads home to his lovely parents, and they inform him that he's going to have to move out. You know, but in fairness, at 23, he doesn't want people to think that he's some sort of queer fella. living at home with his parents at 23. So Bob Senior, as it is, and Doreen, they, you know, need time to themselves to work out a complicated stage in their life, apparently.
Filthy. It's just the way they were looking at each other. That's a giveaway.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, he's got no house now either. So,
but at least they give him 2 weeks to get out.
They do. They give him 2 weeks' notice. Nice. But he goes to kind of be consoled by his girlfriend. He rings her up and he's informed by her, she's called Evelyn, that she wants rid of him as well. She's dumped him for a newer model. She's found herself a real man and she's sick of him being fat and lazy and basically doing nothing.
Like his football.
Yes, yeah. He doesn't take this very well, though. He doesn't take it very gentlemanly.
this is a very good part.
He's calling her a slag and a cunt and all the rest of it, and starts assaulting the telephone box.
Telephone for anyone under 30, I suppose, things that used to be around.
Yes, we used to have to go out into the street to phone people on large boxes. If you've seen Doctor Who, it's one of those. But very nostalgic, all right, telephone box vandalism. It's definitely something, a thing of the past.
Yeah.
But he's spotted by the cops doing this and gets pulled in. And there's a good section here.
This is brilliant.
So the sergeant returns to the police station. Like,
two normal bobbies bring him in, put him in the cell, and then they tell the sergeant what the crack is in the station. In one cell, they have a rapist. Another cell, what is it?
Someone that stabbed somebody.
Someone stabbed someone, and the third cell is Bob himself.
Hmm.
So the sergeant isn't. What did he say about the rapist? He said she was, the way he says it, she was asking for it.
Yeah, yeah.
The fella who stabbed another fella said, "Well, boys will be boys."
Boys will be boys.
And poor old Bob vandalizing the telephone box. That was just an epitome to him. Just
the lowest of the low.
Skull. Absolutely skull.
It's revealed that the sergeant has shares in BT. So he's got a particular grievance with Bob here, and Bob is subjected to some more police brutality during the night.
And it's good. He narrates as he's beating him, telling him why he's beating him, which is lovely.
Absolutely. Well, it's important.
Is it, protecting the share price was the main reason why he kicked the show down for Bob.
So Bob eventually gets out the next morning and goes for a breakfast, which he doesn't have enough money to pay for.
Which he only realises after he's eaten the breakfast, obviously.
Yeah, he's only short a few pence here, but the cafe owner's having none of it, and he also beats him up in the street. And Bob eventually makes his way to work and is then told that his job is being made redundant. So he's going to be
not him,
just his position. Yeah, so he's being let go by the boss here, Mr. Rafferty. He eventually goes to drown his sorrows in a pub. And it's at this point that an old Scottish gentleman approaches him. And this old guy says to him, "You fuck this right up, you daft cunt." And obviously, Bob is a bit perturbed by this. But, he kind of realizes that this isn't just some old Raj. This guy knows everything about him, basically recalls his whole life story to him. And then, says to him, "Nae job, nae house, nae bird, nae mates, police record," just spouting it all out to him, essentially, and reveals that he is God. And he's basically in a vengeful mood, God, at this point.
Very vengeful.
And, Bob is kind of retaliating by saying, "Oh, why would you waste your time on the likes of me?" And God is kind of taking the point that these Rajas always have something to say to him about what he should and shouldn't be doing. And, at the end of the day, he could do what he fucking wants. And
I think why he's most vengeful is because Bob reminds him of himself.
Yes.
He's a lazy cunt as well, which is a good take on if you believe in God and that sort of thing. He must be a lazy cunt considering the state we're all in.
Well, quite possibly. There's definitely some deep questions to be looked into here, but there is a funny quote where he says, "That cunt Nietzsche was wide of the mark when he says that I was dead. I'm not dead. I just didn't give a fuck." So I suppose now the reason that we're reading God in this kind of leet, wide o' outflow way is that that's how Bob sees him, and Bob has no imagination. So he's seen him in his own image. God basically tells Bob that he's nothing more than an insect. And that gives him the idea to turn Bob into an insect.
A fly,
more specifically. And Bob, in the next paragraph, has been turned into a fly. And he goes to visit his friend Kev, He's not too angry with Kev for dropping him from the team. He uses the red sauce, the ketchup from Kev's fish supper, to write his name on the wall so that Kev, you know, to prove to Kev that he is Fly. Sorry, yeah. They'd met him in the pub.
After he spoke to God, he met Kev and told him, I'm after meeting God, he's threatened to turn me into a fly. Kev told him to fuck off as usual.
And now Kev sees that this was indeed the case. So Kev offers to put him up in his house. And it's a traumatic couple of days for Bob, where he has to hide from a spider, which he eventually ventures out with revenge on his mind. And he calls around to Evelyn's house, and it's revealed that she's having sex with her new man, Tambo.
The man who took his place on the football team,
yeah. But in fairness, Tambo does seem to be not only superior on the football pitch, but also between the sheets as well.
He's a good man to use his balls, all right.
And is satisfying Evelyn no end. But Bob sees a chance here for revenge by travelling outside and dipping his whatever antennae legs in dog shite and then putting this in a curry in Tambo's house or Evelyn's house.
Which is beside the bed, which is very...
Yes, well, very it's nice and handy, you know. And so after watching them, in Welch's words, fuck like rabbits in every conceivable position, he doesn't use dog shite, he uses...
Puke. He eats the dog shite and then he pukes it up.
It's not the litter tray.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. It's dog shite in the film we're thinking of.
Yeah.
It's the cat's litter tray in this. Same difference, I would wager.
Yeah,
he munches on a skittery turd that had not yet been buried in the gravel. But yes, this results in, needless to say, Tambo and Evelyn being violently ill with the next day with food poisoning. His next trip is to his old boss Rafferty, and he does basically the same thing but with rat poison. He puts rat poison in Rafferty's sandwich for lunch, and he's very sick the next day also, has to be brought to...
Plus it puts the fear of God in Rafferty, and thinks someone's out to get him.
Yeah, yeah,
he's the
paranoid boss indeed. And then he goes home, Bob.
Oh, this wasn't a good idea.
And things take a really disturbing turn for the worst then.
Very disturbing.
So he's met with the image of his father clad in a black nylon body stocking with a hole at the crotch. And he's basically legs akimbo, bent over the mantelpiece, and Bob's mother is pegging him.
Strap-on dildo.
Yes, indeed.
Ramming him up his anus.
Giving him some severe questioning at the same time. She wants to know who...
Interrogation, I'd say.
Interrogating, yes, absolutely. More of an interrogation than Bob Jr. got in the police station, I would wager.
True. More painful, by the looks of it.
So she wants to know who Bob Sr. has been seeing. And eventually, he lets rip. He gives in that he's been seeing Dolly Parton, no less.
Dirty bastard.
And also Anna Ford. Who's Anna Ford?
What's on the board, Miss Ford?
I don't know who that is. I don't recognise the catchphrase you've just said or the name.
Some word.
But also Madonna. So he's been around dirty old Bob Senior.
But
she's had
Bob's mother is not happy, and she plans a spiteful revenge.
She does. This could mean only one thing.
She's going to have a shite and he's going to have to eat it.
That's apparently what's on the cards here. Bob Senior protests. Don't. We get a sentence here which changes course dramatically. It starts, no, don't shite in my mouth. Don't shite in my mouth. Shite in my mouth. Shite in my mouth. So he's all for it by the end of it. But it sounds a bit... So this is obviously very traumatic for Bob Jr.
Although he does get interrupted by
a phone. Oh, yes. Brilliant. Yeah. So she gets a phone call from her daughter. And
from his Bob's sister.
Yeah. And totally shifts persona to just shoot the breeze with the daughter on the phone while Bob Sr. is still basically assuming the position with the dildo still up him. So she obviously just...
She couldn't get it up any further. Remember that as well.
Very important detail. So she obviously just unstrapped herself to go and take the call. All the while, Bob Jr. is flying around and is starting to annoy them. And eventually, Doreen has had enough and managed to swat him and knocks him to the ground. And basically, they continue what they were doing and eventually retire to bed. But the next morning, they find Bob Jr. back in his human form, lying dead, or more or less dead.
Naked
behind the couch. So they assume that he's had a bad night himself. And this leaves the only person to know the truth about what happened to Bob to be Kev. And he's obviously very traumatized by this. And his life then kind of spirals to mirror that of Bob's, where he's starting to perform really badly for the Grant and Star. He thinks he's going to lose his place, and the team's performance goes down itself. His wife leaves him, or his partner, and he also loses his job. So we're seeing a knock-on effect here, a butterfly effect from this fly story. So it's definitely a good one.
It's one of the best ones in the acid house, I think.
But yeah, I think it's a good story to kind of highlight existential crisis that Bob has had here. He's had the worst day, and as I say, even the intervention from God only makes things worse. He's punished even further and leaves you with the message that there's basically nothing you can do to improve your life. If God is against you, then you're powerless to stop it, essentially.
The moral of the story, basically, is don't be an apathetic, lazy cunt.
Yes, that's good. good advice. All
right. There's more to life than that.
Absolutely. The next story is entitled Snowman Building Parts for Rico the Squirrel.
This is another one that I didn't like.
Well, yeah, it's a weird one. It's, again, kind of experimental writing, if you like. So we get an American family, the Cartwrights, who are very upset that a squirrel, a friend of theirs, Rico the Squirrel, has gone away. Especially their son, Bobby, is very upset about this. And, he's very hurt by this. But, Rico had taught this family not to be sad. It's to kind of, push away their sad feelings and feel better in life. And the dad especially reminds the son of this, that even though Bobby's little sister had been run over and killed by the drunk sheriff, that, they managed to get their lives back on track after this. So it's a real kind of loved up, almost American sitcom is the way this is written. And then strangely, it switches to the family. Yes. What about the other family, Jim?
They'd be more down to earth, shall we say. More working class.
Yes.
Living in the schemes. Basically, the tale of the parents shagging at the kitchen table. One's thinking, the father's thinking about shagging Madonna, and the mother is thinking about shagging Keanu Reeves. And basically getting caught by the kids.
Yeah, it's definitely a different tale. It's not your loved up American sitcom. The weird thing about this course is that the children in both families, certainly the child, Sean, in the Robinson's family in Scotland, he's watching the American family, the Cartwrights, on a sitcom, with Rico the Squirrel. So it's this kind of break of the fourth wall, if you like. It's this weird intertwining of the two stories through. And even in the print on the pages, the Scottish family story is within squares to differentiate between that and the American family story. But yeah, it switches back and forward. As you say, things aren't going to end too badly or too well for Sean, because he's been spying on his mother and her lover, this lovely gentleman, Tony Anderson. And he's obviously about to get a beating for that. Whereas the Americans' family, their story ends with Rico coming back and all is well in the world. But it's revealed then that Bobby is also watching the Robinsons' family on his TV in America. And he remarks that he hopes that things are going to work out okay for Sean in that family, to which Rico replies, "I fucking doubt it."
Exactly, it's highly unlikely.
So you get this kind of heartwarming US family versus the harsh reality of the Scottish family. I think it's a funny comparison. It's a bit like that Doesn't Matter story, where it's just, comparing life in Leith to what goes on in the rosy world of America.
I think Welsh may have went on holidays or something to Florida.
Quite possibly.
These couple of stories.
Indeed.
You can just imagine them there in the Disneyland with his Mickey Mouse t-shirt and his foam finger.
Yes. But obviously, it's a tragic tale if you look at it from the point of view of this young fella, Sean, for one thing. The next one then is another short one and another kind of strange one in terms of experimental writing. It's called Sport for All. It's a quick and funny tale, I think. It's basically two conversations, again, in a split screen type effect, which in both cases, we get only one side of both conversations. And they're both by an unnamed person who's clearly elite, Wido.
He's a scumbag.
Yeah, he's a Hibs casual, I think. So he's obviously approached another guy. And we learn from his questioning to this other person and then his answers back to his mates on the other side of the page that the other guy is, a posh rugby lover who's obviously intimidated by him. This guy is questioning, his sexuality, what he does for a living. and eventually kind of forces him into a sing-song and eventually forces him to buy drinks for him and his mates before, you know, leaving him alone in, to go on his way in peace. So it's cleverly done. I mean, we don't hear the point of view of the other guy at all, but we know exactly what he must be thinking.
Yeah, this is rash.
There's no violence, as you say, but there's certainly the threat of it. You can just imagine what's going through that guy's head. So it's cleverly done in that sense, and it's a pretty short story. And that leads us to the last of the short stories before we get to the novella, and it's entitled The Acid House.
Not too short for a short story, in fairness.
No, it's long enough. Yeah, it's almost a novella itself, really. So this is another memorable one. This is the last of the stories that was made, you know, incorporated into the film version. What did you think of this one?
It was good. I thought it could have been better, but it was. I thought Coco Bryce, as he is, was a bit too obvious,
right?
Too in your face, like too brainless.
He's very on the nose, all right.
Yeah, like there's nothing subtle about him at all. It's just pure pig-headed gobshite, really.
Yeah. Now to just say it, Welch really lays it on thick with this guy to, I suppose, really emphasise the difference between him and this kind of perceived posher couple, for this, you know, middle-class couple that he swaps roles with. So, yeah, Coco Bryce, another Hibs casual, I believe. He's dropped acid in a park in Super Mario's, no less, yes. In a park during a lightning storm, which is always a good idea. He gets hit by said lightning and swaps bodies with a soon-to-be-born baby.
Gets hit by lightning at the same time.
Yeah, the ambulance where the mother was travelling to. So this is a middle-class family, as I say, called Jenny and Rory. And basically, we got a good few pages then detailing the swap in bodies between the two, this baby and the character of Coco Bryce. And it's, again, all these pages are a really good example of Welch experimenting with his writing formats and the kind of layout of the print. There's literally a couple of pages that have nothing but the word light, with kind of little small paragraphs incorporated into it, which are like flashbacks of Coco Bryce's own life. You know, it sounds like he had a tough enough upbringing with his lovely father, an abusive father by the sounds of it. There's little extracts of him kind of being, you know, incorporated into the Hibs casual scene and meeting his girlfriend. But there's some really funny bits then when he does swap places with this baby. Brilliant bits where he's enjoying being breastfed a bit too much.
Well, who wouldn't have been?
And standing up at the end of his cot, watching his parents, inverted commas, having sex. And then we also get him kind of drinking the house's booze supply behind their back and also puking it back up.
And then the complete opposite end of the scale, you have his supposed father, who's an absolute nonce.
Yes, well, this is Rory.
Rory, yes.
Well, he sounds like a bit of a plonker.
Yes.
Certainly, he sounds like a boring man, and even Jenny kind of sees this side to him. Yeah, he's played really well in the film version, I think, Martin Clunes. Yeah, the story develops with Coco in the form of this baby, you know, talking to Jenny because she's threatening to bring him down to Manchester away from Rory for a while, and he's having none of this. So he has to start talking to her and kind of convinces her that he's this miracle baby. He tries to stop himself talking in his native Leith tongue to avoid suspicion, but he doesn't really achieve this. But he does convince her to bring him to Easter Road for a match. And this is a brilliant image to picture her at the match. And this newborn child is, you know, fascinated with the Hibs casuals and what they're up to beside him rather than what's going on the pitch, why the baby would even be at the match in the first place. It comes to a head. Eventually, the two characters, I suppose, they kind of adapt to their own situations, I think, and they forget their real selves. I mean, obviously, the baby, Tom, as he was named by his parents, he's kind of then moulded into the perfect fiancé by Coco's girlfriend. You know, she's happy to have him away from the drug scene, away from the Hibs casual scene, and is going to basically have him as her lapdog. But he essentially becomes a better partner to her in that sense. But the end meeting then, they actually meet on the bus, and it's kind of trippy as fuck, in fairness. You know, you get the two of them meeting, and whether they have thoughts back to their old selves or what, it's just weird the way they're kind of both left almost traumatized by meeting each other. But I thought it was an interesting ending. It ends differently to how it ends with the film. In the film, they touch and basically go back into their own bodies. Yeah. whereas this one is left more ambiguous. It's, as I say, it's really left with the theory that nature versus nurture, I guess, that these two characters are put in totally separate bodies and totally separate situations and different walks of life and result in different types of people, really. It's a bit of a tinker in that sense, but I thought it was a good one. It had some funny moments, and it's definitely one of the more memorable stories from
it. It's one of the better ones.
So we're done with the short stories, and we're just on to the novella at the end, which is entitled A Smart Cunt. I mean, we're not going to go into a huge amount of detail here on this.
Dirty fucking bastard.
I think this is, you know, it's sometimes funny, but mostly I think a depressing story of this character, Brian, who I think is a real victim of his surroundings most of the time. You know, I think he's a lot like Mark Renton, again, in that he's of above average intelligence, but, you know, he largely depends on drugs, probably for hedonistic purposes, but also from a kind of social dependency aspect. What did you think of this story, or Brian in particular?
I think it's a tale of a lot of modern day life where people just, they have nothing, they've nothing in their life, and they just fill it up with drink and drugs.
Yeah.
And they just plod along weekend after weekend after weekend, and they've no interest in sports, they've no interest in their job, they've no interest in anything. So yeah. They just get out of their minds as often as possible and see what happens.
It's pretty grim. I mean,
it is grim.
Yeah. I found this depressing to read, as I say, a lot of the time. I mean, he has lots of friends, and, you know, he kind of spends time with them depending on the drug of choice at the time. He says it himself, that certain friends, certain drugs with them. But he's not a nice person a lot of the time, obviously. Obviously, this is largely down to him being the titular smart cunt. And this kind of becomes a running joke in the novella where it's said to him quite often, you know, and he's almost a bit too big for his boots or a bit too smart for his own good in certain situations. But it also leads to him basically being involved in killing a blind man, this man's only crime, apart from being blind, was to be, you know, a bit annoying and possibly have some sort of social disability himself, which, again, was probably undiagnosed given his...
where he was.
Yeah, exactly. And just being in the wrong place, walking home one night, you know, he's attacked by these two, this character Roxy and this guy Brian. So Roxy is perhaps more to blame for that debt, and is certainly the worst person in the scenario, because he eventually pisses on blind cunts.
I thought about that.
Well, yeah.
In the end, we find out it was...
Yes, indeed.
Brian who gives the final blow.
Yeah. We're left.
Although he didn't piss on the first.
No, he did have a change of character and a change of heart at that point, and had the good sense to not piss on this poor man's grave.
You shit on him, though.
Not on him. The other act that he takes part on that really shows his wanker side is when he and others, including character Denise, who is a homosexual character, presumably was called Dennis but is now called Denise, and they basically get their so-called friend Ronnie, who's
permanently jellied.
Yes, permanently jellied. A very tragic but comical character nonetheless.
Don't say that, someone say.
Yes. So as you say, he just goes around the whole time like a zombie, and certainly ends every occasion just flat out comatose. And on one occasion, he's the subject of having lots of bodily fluids thrown on him, and all the rubbish they could find in a flat. And
two cocks in each ear.
Yeah, he's basically sexually assaulted, you know, by this guy, Denise, and some other guy. So, yeah, not just a horrible scenario, which they obviously thought was hilarious at the time. But I didn't find this guy, Denise, likable whatsoever. And, you know, because he was just annoying, not because he was homosexual. But, he's also a lawyer. It's revealed that... He's going around saying that he once had sex, you know, he broke his kind of homosexual tendencies.
Vaginal virginity.
Yes. No, that's not what I was going to say.
It is.
He broke his homosexual tendencies to have sex with this girl, Ollie, who would eventually become Brian's girlfriend, I believe. But as I say, yeah, he assaulted, sexually assaulted the intoxicated Ronnie. by putting his penis in his mouth. Yeah, I mean, there is funny moments as well. I like the bit at the start or near the start where Brian is working as the park.
Yeah, it started off well, actually, but then it just got spoiled out. But in the park was very good.
I mean, he's certainly some chancer, was he? He basically moved into the office.
Living in the digs in the park behind the boiler.
Stuffing his mattress behind the boiler and turning on the hot water to his, when he needed it. And I loved the bit where he's just too fucking lazy to get up off his arse and put the heating on after this match for these footballers, and has the barefaced cheek to look them in the eye and tell them that it's, you know, down to the department and down to somebody else. Yeah. And then promptly puts the heating on because he's going out himself that night. I also like the bit, he's travelling up and down to London quite a lot. Again, reminiscent of the characters in Trainspotting. And I suppose plays to the fact that he's, as you say, he's just not happy where he is and is trying to escape, but then doesn't like his situation down in London either. He's hanging around with a lot of scrotes down there as well. Mm. But I did like the bit where he has an office job in London and is invited back to a colleague's house for dinner, which eventually leads to him having sex on the way home in the car with this older lady. She reveals that her husband had a heart attack, so he's on heart medicine, so he can't get an erection. So she has sexual needs that need to be satisfied. But for some reason, while he's having sex with this guy, Brian keeps thinking of Graeme Souness, just keeps thinking of Graeme Souness' performance in the 1982 World Cup.
Which was astonishing.
Yeah, I think it was her vagina, the hair on her vagina that reminded him of Graeme Souness' facial.
Her vagina had a big run on it, so kept him going.
So there's some funny bits, and obviously a really funny section is when this character, Ronnie, actually gets married. So the fact he has a girlfriend in the first place is unbelievable. And there's a funny bit where his girlfriend talks Brian and this girl, Ollie, into going around to her parents' house because Ronnie by himself isn't making a very good impression on her father.
not once had he stayed awake.
I love the way Brian excuses his kind of comatose state on the fact that he's been working a lot of late shifts. But the wedding day itself, what better way to celebrate your mate's wedding than by dropping acid, which is what they do. And we actually get reintroduced to Spud and Raimi from Trainspotting here. And Spud even remarks on the fact that his mate, Renton, ripped him off and headed for the hills. I'm just trying to pitch them. They're at a wedding reception and they're hallucinating that there's a polar bear on the dance floor. But as I say, I mean, this guy Brian, he's a real victim of his surroundings, and I think that is the case with a lot of characters in Welsh's books. And you know, he gets increasingly more paranoid. He's certainly depressed, but kind of undiagnosed with depression, if you like.
Well, he did kill a man, so
it does play on his mind eventually. But it ends on an even more tragic note when he learns that his long since departed mother actually died in Australia from a fire. He hadn't seen or heard her since she left. His father has remarried as well. I suppose that's a funny section where his father is heavily involved in the anti-drug scene in the neighbourhood, much to the chagrin of Brian himself. But as I say, it ends on a really tragic note, and it ends really with him going nowhere and you'd have to worry about his future.
An aimless life.
Yes. But, you know, it's a good little novella. But as I say, it is depressing, I think. Yeah. So that's A Smart Cunt. And that is the end of the book. We're going to do a quick section now with our favourite bits, which is just kind of either funny or what we thought is good writing in the book. Jem, you have a section there that you liked in... What is it in?
Snuff. It's just a description of a beautiful area in Leeds. It goes, a row of cherry blossoms by the landscape bank of a stagnant river gave off a pleasing aroma. Smith strolled along as the twilight began to give away to darkness. His steps disturbed a group of youths in hooded tops who dropped their voices and sneaked furtive, then brazenly threatening looks at him. Smith, blind to them in his thoughts, strode on. He passed the wheezing alcoholics on the benches, whose dislocated growls snapped at demons remembered or imagined. The empty cans of super lager, the broken glass, the used condoms and the dog shite. A hundred yards away, an old stone bridge arched darkly across still, rancid waters.
a lovely snapshot there of an area elite. You know, I think possibly the only thing that would change in modern times is in between the discarded condoms, you'd add in discarded face masks, and then you'd be sorted.
Yeah, I've got one from the first story, The Shooter. And it's just a small bit where the character Gary, when he goes back to his flat, is just remembering, you know, his girlfriend who's left him and how lonely the flat is. And it says, despite the fact that she'd taken her stuff and gone months ago, there was still traces of her here. A glove, a scarf, a poster she'd brought stuck up on the wall. These Russian dolls we got from Covent Garden. The presence of such articles always loomed large in times of stress. Now they were overpowering. What's the other one you have, Jen?
It's from The Last Resort in the Adriatic.
Hmm.
I slipped along the empty deck, struggling to remain erect. The sea was calm and the light balmy. A couple of lovers enjoying the moonlight looked suspiciously at me as I shuffled past them to my spot on the starboard side. 10 years, almost to the day, Joan, when you slipped out and away from me, away from the pain and hurt. I lift one leg with an almighty effort over the barrier. I just get my blessed breath back, take one last look at the purple sky, then allow my weight to shift and I'll spill from the rails into the Adriatic.
Tragic. Okay, and the last one I have is from the story The Acid House, and it's this character Jenny, you know, who's heavily pregnant, just kind of describing men in general, or specifically her partner Rory. What did it take out of them physically? It was just another fuck for those bastards. We had it all to do, but there they are telling us how to do it, controlling us, gynecologists, fathers-to-be, all men, together in a sickly, pragmatic conspiracy. The scumbags have already disengaged emotionally from you. You're just the receptacle to carry the precious fruit of their sweaty bollocks into the world through your fucking blood. But you're being hysterical, darling. It's all those hormones all over the place. Just listen to us. We know best. So a pretty accurate description of most men, I would imagine, there are certainly a lot of them, in fairness. And the next section we have then is disturbing bits. So, Jem, you have some bits that disturbed you greatly from the book?
Well, it's a bit from the Grafton Star Cause when he was flying around his fly and he was watching his mother and his father. And let's just say, we just go with this. He knew he could not trust himself to see his mother's shite. It would be too arousing. That succulent, hot, sour feces, all going into his father's mouth. Bob felt his first conscious twinges of an Oedipus complex. At 23 years old and in a metamorphosized state.
Yes, that's definitely would be classed as disturbing.
It would be if you're getting too aroused by your mother's succulent, hot, sour feces.
I've also got a disturbing bit from just before that, also concerning Bob and his kind of metamorphosis into a fly. So it says, he also gained a taste for excrement, its rich, sour moistness tantalizing his long insect tongue. The other blue bottles who crowded onto the hot shite were not so bad. Bob was attracted to some of them. He'd learned to appreciate the beauty of the insect body, the sexy, huge brown eyes, the glistening external skeleton, the appealing mosaic of blue and green, the rough, coarse hairs, and the shimmering wings which reflected the sun's golden light. Pretty beautiful.
Poetic.
So, that's enough disturbance, I think, for now. Our next section is called Connecting Lines. And in Connecting Lines, I just kind of mention any characters that we've seen before in previous Welsh novels. Obviously, at this point, we've only read Trainspotting, but we do in this novel see again Spud and Raimi from Trainspotting. Obviously, Spud and Raimi are pretty good friends with Brian in the novella A Smart Cunt. And Renton and Swanee are also mentioned in this story. And also mentioned in this story is Mikey Forrester, of course, famously played by Irvine Welsh in the film Trainspotting. But Mikey Forrester's character seems to have taken a bit more of a sinister turn because he's mentioned as having taken part in a rape in the novella A Smart Cunt. So that was Connecting Lines. And that just leaves our last section, our overall thoughts. Basically, Jen, what did you think overall of the Acid House collection?
I wouldn't say it was my favourite Irvine Welsh book. There were some very good bits. There were some bits I really didn't like. So middle of the road, I suppose.
Okay.
But you could see he was his writing style was changing. He was experimenting with a few things.
Mm.
You can see him coming along in further on books, which I suppose you have to start somewhere.
Absolutely, yeah. It is written very early on in his career. Marks out of five?
Oh, five? Well, I was going to go out of 10, but out of five, I will go...
We do five here on Junk Dilemmas, James.
Bollocks. I will go with 2.5. It was a bit middle of the road for me. It was some very good bits, but some bits I just didn't want to read. So. Yeah,
okay. But you did anyway.
I did anyway.
Like a trooper.
Like a trooper. And I watched the film.
You did, and we're going to talk about that as well in our next episode. But yeah, overall for myself, I mean, I mentioned that this book was written very soon after Trainspotting, so I think a lot of the story is very much in that vein. You know, they centre around characters that, you know, are marred with drugs and crime and unemployment. You know, stories like Stoke Newington Blues or Euro Trash. So they could have easily been slotted into Trainspotting, really. And I think there could be no doubt that in the story of Brian in the novella A Smart Cunt that finishes off the collection, I mean, it very much reads almost like the little brother of Trainspotting. You know, he even remarks that he counts Spud and Raimi and Swanee as kind of more experienced friends of his in the tale. But I think what separates this collection from Trainspotting, as you say, is definitely the surreal and kind of funny stories that, like the title character, The Acid House, or the Grant and Star Cause, they kind of infuse the tragic everyday life of Leet with this almost insane supernatural occurrences like body swapping or shape shifting. The character development and the dialogue in these stories is already as funny as usual from Welch, but then they're kind of tipped over the edge with these fantastical edges added to them. But there's lots of themes tackled in this. I mean, you know, we get more subtle nods to some than others, but, you know, personal issues like depression, paranoia, grief, lack of self-worth, sexual inadequacy, or larger problems across society like, you know, racism, homophobia, and, you know, crime and associated violence or poverty, class divide. But, I mean, they're all in here mashed together in this kind of crazy intoxicating potion or, indeed, a tab of acid. And with that, I will give The Acid House 3.5 out of 5.
On the Richter scale.
Absolutely. So that's it for The Acid House. Thanks for listening. And on our next episode, we will be discussing the film adaptation of The Acid House. So join us then. Say goodbye, James.
Good luck.
Thank you.